to stand together on common ground. We've got to bend together or we all fall down.
Welcome to This Is Civity. I'm Gina Valeria. Civity is a culture of deliberately engaging in relationships of respect and empathy with others who are different, moving people from us versus them to we all belong. To learn more, go to civity.org. In this episode, we talk with Michael McRae, experiential story coach and founder of Becoming Restoried. Michael helps others find and share their own stories toward healing, reconciling, and connection. When someone does not have control of their own story, it can be dehumanizing. Michael helps people see both themselves and each other as human, which in turn connects us across divides, differences, and unknowns. The idea of story as foundational to your work. So I thought it might be interesting to start with our own civity intervention as a way to springboard our own conversation. And so I wanted to ask you, why do you do what you do? So why do you do what you do?
It's a great question. I get asked this a lot, and I feel like I always have a different answer because there's so many intersecting threads, right? So many different roots that have brought me here. So in one way, I would answer the question around when I was 23, I moved to Belfast in Northern Ireland to do grad school. And I very early on in that discovered storytelling, public storytelling, like in front of a crowd, but also facilitated storytelling through the context of conflict transformation. And it completely lit me up. And so there was like a whole somatic reaction. I was just like, oh my gosh, I'm on fire. Like, this is what I'm supposed to do. I felt alive, like just so passionate and focused. And so I had that experience of feeling like, oh, this is a real passion of mine. What connects it to a sense of purpose for me is my own story early on in my life of growing up in conservative religion, growing up with something called purity culture, and then being attacked relatively frequently in high school, severe bullying, experiences of sexual assault regularly for a couple of years, that led to a tremendous amount of self-loathing and self-doubt in my own life that led me to a suicide attempt when I was 20. And so I have spent most of my life feeling like I cannot seem to reconcile myself to the story that I want to be true about my life, and like feeling this deep sense of disconnect, and seeing also what happens when people develop stories about others that are dehumanizing, and to see like, oh, I know what it feels like when that happens to me. And so I've had this longing to help others do the thing that I've been trying to do my whole life, which is to reconcile myself to my story, to be at peace with myself, and then to help people be at peace in the world. And to know that for me, the root of that is story, the stories that we create about other people inform the way that we engage with them. And so really feeling the importance of tending to the stories I tell myself about who I am, which is what's led me to Becoming Restoried, the coaching program I do, and also the stories that we tell ourselves about others, which led me into peace building and conflict resolution.
When I talk with people who are doing this kind of work, and either the bridging work across differences and democracy and things like that, or the work of sharing stories to help other people reconcile their own stories, there is, I think for a lot of us, and myself included, although my story may not be as dramatic as yours, ideas of being othered. A lot of people come into this work knowing what it feels like to be othered, right? So with that in mind, you know, this is a story that I know you're telling me here, and I've heard you tell it on your TED Talk. You're really able, you've encapsulated and been able to tell your story and share the things you've shared, which are so difficult and heart-wrenching, as you've so, you know, astutely honed in on. A lot of people don't know how to admit that or face their story, et cetera. How do you think you've come to the place where you can just be like, hey, let me rattle off my story and all of these things that are people, you know what I mean, that people see as terrible, but that I'm freely sort of saying in a what seemingly comfortable way? How do you think you were able to find a way to do that?
Well, a ton of therapy. So we'll start there. So started doing therapy a few weeks after the suicide attempt. So I was 20 years old. I'm 35 now. And so just regularly doing, all kinds of therapy, from trauma intensives to EMDR to brain spotting to cognitive behavioral therapy to somatic therapy, just all kinds of things to try to feel well. So I've done a lot of processing. Second, I do storytelling for a living. And so I'm practiced at how to tell stories in a way that feels helpful. I've seen a lot of examples of ways that people tell stories that are not helpful. I have a belief that, especially when it comes to telling stories in public, that we should tell stories from our scars and not our wounds. Because when we tell stories from our open wounds, we will bleed all over the audience and the people listening. And I want to speak from the place of saying, oh, this was a wound, but it's scar tissue now. And I can tell you what that means to me now. I didn't talk publicly about, for instance, the suicide attempt for probably 7 years after it happened. And so there's that belief. There's also a belief that comes from recovery, which is we're only as sick as our secrets. And so I'm not interested in living with a lot of shame because I've done that for most of my life. I believe in using discernment and wisdom to talk publicly about things that I've heretofore felt like I was supposed to live in shame about. And then in doing that in small circles, like with trusted people, and noticing that every single time I talked about the assaults, the bullying, the suicide attempt, I was met with compassion. I was met with curiosity, and often was met with, oh my gosh, me too. I feel that, right? And so what I have learned consistently is that when I show up with an authentic, a wise and discerning vulnerability, it almost always helps the people that I'm talking about. I have yet to have a true experience where someone's like, are you kidding me? That's like why would you ever do that, right? Why would you ever want to take your own life? It's just like people aren't messing with it. They're like, oh, I've had suicidal ideation too. And I didn't know we could talk about that. And I'm like, oh, we can. And especially then as a male who has experienced sexual assault, very few men ever talk about this, but it happens a lot, especially in locker rooms. And so I'm very interested in trying to be one small part of normalizing a conversation around the fact that this happens to men too. And that when we don't process it, we repress the anger and the trauma. And trauma that's not transformed is transferred, which is why I think men have a tendency to be more violent than women. Yeah, so I would say that those are part of the reasons why. Just a lot of practice and starting in small ways and letting it grow and realizing like just for instance, I was in LA last week at a conference with a group called Unlikely Collaborators. I was asked at the beginning of the conference to share for a thing called Failibration. And so it's this little part where we like celebrate our failures. And so I was asked to do the final 4-minute story. And they wanted me to talk about the failure of my marriage. I got divorced last year. And what I've learned from it. And so I told this 4-minute story about the divorce and mentioned in there about the bullying and the assaults. Just like one little line, but I mentioned it. It's kind of the same way I did at the start of this. There was a panel immediately afterwards of 5 people who were supposed to talk about their own failures and their own experiences and mistakes. And the last guy had prepared an entire talk for 5 minutes. And he set his notebook down and he said, I'm actually going to talk about something I've literally never spoken about in public because of that guy's share. And he talked about being molested as a kid by his own mother and what that did to him. And he said, I've literally never had this conversation out loud in a group of people. But I believe also that men should start talking about this. And so it was one of those examples for me. It's just like, yeah, like when I show up having done the work and share, it opened the door for someone else to say, oh, now I'm going to do that, which is going to open the door for somebody else. And yeah. And so I think vulnerability leads to trust and trust leads to vulnerability. And these things lead to healing.
That's huge. I would love to see more of that. I tell my students, so I teach journalism and I teach digital media and podcasting and radio. And I specifically tell my radio students because that, you know, it's getting on the air. People are on your side, you know, like they don't want to see you fail. They want you to do a good job. So if you make a mistake on the air, that's all right. And if you share something, and then we talk about sharing and being vulnerable, and not that I encourage them to share what they don't want to share, but the idea is you'll be surprised that people will be on your side. And what you just shared is sort of an example of that. And you also brought up an interesting point at the beginning about share your scars, not your wounds. To me as a writer, analogous to, I don't know who said it. It's been attributed to, but that, sorry, my story was so long, I didn't have time to prepare. And the idea of, you know, the idea of being able to really sit with and prepare and think about the meaning of your story is I think a big deal. And also, like you said, can draw connections across divides or differences or even unknowns. Earlier, you said story lit you up when you had that first experience. Why is it that you think story and storytelling lit you up?
Grew up in a family that told a lot of stories. My grandmother was kind of the keeper of the family stories. She and my granddad traveled to like 40 different countries. He was an archaeologist and a New Testament professor. And so I grew up in a culture of like when we gathered, we would just, we'd hear the same stories over and over again. They became like a family liturgy and ritual. And I was also a very imaginative kid. Like my parents had to limit the movies that my brother and I watched because we would go and act all of them out the moment we saw them, right? I'd try to like jump off something high when I watched Peter Pan to see if I could fly. And we grew up big like Lord of the Rings fans. And so me and my brother and our two best friends were constantly like making our own movies and playing out these stories. Let's be these guys. We always start, let's be these guys who are going to do this. And so just a very rich imagination. I also just, I think in images a lot. It's one reason that I've become very good at experiential coaching, which is all about helping create an image of what we're dealing with as opposed to just sitting and talking about it. Because my mind just works that way. It's just like someone's telling me something and I immediately see it as a metaphor. Or like, oh, this room, like when you're talking, I'm seeing this image of like a kite flying and someone anchoring this to the ground. It's like, that's just what happens in my brain. And story works well for that. Story is all about creating images and scenes, right? And that's what makes a story stick. There's interesting research that says you're 22 times more likely to remember something that you learn through a story than through like data and information. And it's because the story is working on images and these images become very sticky in the brain and they help us, right? They help us visualize something. And so there's both this like sense of, I grew up with a love of this. I'm imaginative. I have an image-based way of thinking. I don't know. I think I just kind of have a proclivity to like be in a state of like wonder and awe about the world and to be really curious about it. And I've always been very wired for empathy. Empathy's come very easy for me. I'm also a middle child, so I was often stuck in between things. And so, yeah, like hearing people tell true stories about their lives just sort of feels like medicine in a way, you know? And yeah, my brain, like it refuels me. I listen to it for hours. It gives me energy. Because I think, especially in high school, when there were the assaults, I felt very isolated in a way. Even though there's like in one level, I was a popular kid. I was on the basketball team, these things, but I felt very isolated in another way. And so I've had a pretty intense hunger for like vulnerability and intimacy and like connection and belonging. And so like a place where people are telling stories and connecting is a very attractive thing. There's one of my favorite quotes about story is that the shortest distance between two people is a story. It collapses the distance, right? And it's like I've always had a strong hunger to feel very close to people. And there's like there's no more effective way to do that than to share and hear stories.
Your journey has brought you to a place where civity is in this idea of sharing stories to connect across differences and divides and to just see each other as human before you start doing the work of whatever it is you need to do the work on together, right? Community issues or problems or societal or democracy, whatever the case may be. I'm wondering if you are able to share any anecdotes about people that you've worked with discovering aspects of their stories, or even you started that amazing story group in Nashville.
10 by 9.
Any anecdotes about people discovering aspects of their stories or sharing meaningful or potent conversations that have really affected the room or reverberated?
So many. 10 by 9, for those listening, is a public storytelling event where 9 people have 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their life based on a theme. Started in Belfast, established by Padraig O Tuama and Paul Doran. And then I discovered it in Belfast and brought it back here. I've run it every month for 10 and a half years. So we've had over 1,000 stories told. So there's a lot of examples to pull from. Yeah, really beautiful examples of, I had one guy who had never told a story out loud, like in public. And his first story, he ended up coming out as a gay man at 65 years old. And just like the theme was the first time. And so he's like, this is the first time that I've ever told people that I'm gay. Got a standing ovation, ended up telling 14 stories over the next several years. And so seeing him like discover that it was okay to be who he was and that could actually be received when he opened up. And he felt safe to do that because of the way that the event is held, the structure of it, that there's guidelines. There's like, it's not just a free for all. Yeah. Had people talk about a lot of really powerful things. And I tried to model that pretty regularly. I told a story last month about a really painful thing that happened during the divorce when I was moving my stuff out of the house and my little 2-year-old like literally chasing me down the sidewalk, telling me that he loved me while he watched me drive away. It was heartbreaking. I've like wept almost every time that I've talked about it. But the amount of people came up afterwards to talk about their own experiences of growing up with divorced parents or their own experience of divorce. And a couple people who were just like, I would have never thought about like that experience in divorce, like those little behind the scenes moments of like agony. And so kind of seeing people also get glimpses into other people's reality is, I think, really powerful.
You're listening to This Is Civity. I'm Gina Valeria. We're talking with Michael McRae, experiential story coach and founder of Becoming Restoried. We're discussing the importance of reconciling yourself with your own story and truly hearing and engaging with the stories of others.
But I think when you asked the question, the thing I thought of the most, and this will give you just like a little, I'm going to geek out for a second on experiential design. I'm going to give away basically one of the things that I've created. But I was doing a three-day intensive for a client. So an intensive is where a client will schedule, in this case, 3 days with me. She comes to Nashville and I meet her to learn like what it is that you're trying to get unstuck on. What are you looking for clarity on? What are you trying to heal? And then I create in the spur of the moment an experiential process for her. I have a whole suitcase of stuff with like scarves and note cards and stuffed animals and, you know, markers and everything that we could, that we can use, little like figurines. So she was 72. She was very desperate to no longer like be consumed in self-doubt, to feel like a failure, to feel like her family constantly made her feel like she wasn't worth much, that she didn't amount to anything. She'd been doing therapy for a long time and really wanted to figure it out. And so I had this experience of telling a therapist in California once when I was living out there. I said, honestly, if I could just learn to love and trust myself, I feel like everything would be solved in my life. And she said, well, the secret is you already do, because we're all born with pristine mirrors through which to see ourselves with love and compassion. The problem is that over the course of our lives, our mirrors become so covered in shame and pain and like the muck of that, that we can't see the truth of who we are anymore. And so that the task is not to learn to love yourself. The task is to scrape away everything that keeps you from seeing that you already do, which is a very helpful reorientation. And so I kept thinking in this intensive, how do I create that moment for her? And so what I did is I had her get a big piece of paper, had her draw a silhouette of her face. And I said, fill this with everything that reminds you of yourself. You can draw images, words, whatever. So she drew that. We stuck it on the wall. And it was a very positive relationship to it. Then I was like, okay, so who are the people in your life that have given you the most pain and shame? She mentioned mom and her siblings. So I had her make what's called a sculpt for each one. Get a chair, find a scarf that represents them, and put some pictures on them that can feel like it holds their energy. So we had then basically the representation of her family. And then I said, now I want you to go through and name every message of shame and self-doubt that you've lived with in your life. We're going to write one per sticky note. And so she began to do that. And every time she gave me one, we would put the sticky note up on her silhouette so that by the end, her silhouette is entirely covered with sticky notes of shame messages. And so then the task was to find a scarf that can represent the truth, and that this is the scarf of truth. Every time you stand on it, you have to tell the truth. And if you're not ready to tell the truth, don't stand on the scarf. And so then what I did was I had her take each shame message, read it out loud, and tell me who that message came from, who gave it to you. And if it feels like it's more about them than you, then give the message back to them. And so for each one, she would say who it came from. She walked over to the sculpt, gave it back to them. And I said, great. So if that message is not true, what's the actual truth about yourself? And so, for instance, like I remember one where she was like, the message that I got was, I'm a problem child. That came from my mom. I was like, so give it back to mom. So if you're not a problem child, what's the truth? And it took her a minute, but she stood on that scarf of truth. And I remember her going, the truth is that my mom did not have the capacity or ability to parent me the way that I needed. And I was like, yes, right? Like but her mom interpreted that as her being a problem, but it's not her responsibility. She was a kid, right? It's like her mom didn't know how to do it. And so by the end, like she was just in this place of like, oh my gosh, like she felt totally free of the self-doubt, of feeling a failure, of realizing that all the shame she's been living with was given to her by other people, that it didn't belong to her. And she literally handed it back to them and then had to tell what the truth was. And then I had her take all those truth messages and write them in the white space around her silhouette. And it was it worked far better than I ever imagined that it would work. And because I was just holding my mind, it's like, how do I help her scrape this stuff off of her mirror? And so it's like, that's what I came up with. I call the process scrape the mirror. But to see her like engage her story that way and to leave being like, oh, I'm actually okay. This was never actually about me. This was about them projecting their pain onto me. It's like, yes, yes. just shows to me also the power of experiential work, right? If I was just to sit and have a conversation with her, we're likely not going to get there. She had to actually go through a process of creating something and seeing the image of it, right? Actually moving the shame messages off of her face and onto the people that they came from.
That's really related to a very Buddhist concept of you keep your gift of negative energy. You know, I don't need that. You keep that. That is beautiful. And I really appreciate you sharing that story. So to move it into sort of the space of engagement with each other, seeing each other's humanity, why do you think people show up for your gatherings in Nashville?
10 by 9 specifically, I think people show up because they're given the opportunity and permission to just feel the fullness of like being a person. And because it's not a comedy night, and it's not a trauma bearing night. So it's like we have stories where it's hilarious, followed by like a story like mine, where it's like about this experience with my kid. And so in any given night, I often say like, you're going to hear stories that break your heart, but then stories that put it back together. I also think the increase of technology, AI, all of these things are leading people to have a real hunger for genuine human connection. Like we're more and more technologically connected, but then physically estranged in a way. And in today's world, it's often, especially for young adults, a lot of people are probably under the age of 40 who come to the event now. It's hard to meet other people. Like there aren't gathering spaces. Like there's not the public square like they used to have, where it's like if you needed to do something in town, you went to the public square. It's where everyone gathered. Now everything is spread out. There's like very few opportunities, which is why we have dating apps, for instance. Just like we have to curate this. Like it just doesn't happen for people. And so 10 by 9 is, I think, become a place for them to show up, to hear stories that enrich them, that make them feel something significant, but also then to meet other people who share some of the same values and interests. And to just have, and it's free, to have a community gathering place once a month. I don't think it's an accident that the more technologically advanced we get, the more storytelling events are on the rise. And that there's like a real kind of renaissance moment of public storytelling happening. Stories also like going all over the business world, right? It's the buzzword. Everyone wants to do story work now. And because like, humanity, I think more and more is kind of getting sucked out of the workplace and being kind of siphoned away from our natural social orbits. And so we have to be very intentional in creating a space to do that. And so, yeah, I think it's like a hunger for human connection that drives people to the event.
I always think about it in journalism when in the early, say, 19th century, we may have disagreed on everything, but I still had to help you mend your fence, say, or I don't know, get your animal out of a ditch or whatever. We had to work together. We had to be neighbors. And that is less and less. I don't need to ask you for directions anymore. I can just go to my phone. So I think you're onto something there with the idea of just finding some humanity or human connection in this world of technology.
Because we're not wired to function that way, right? We are evolutionarily wired to belong to each other. It's how we have survived this long, is that people realize, oh, the best way for me to survive the saber-toothed tiger or the, you know, the village over there that may want our resources is to band together. And so that sense of like tribal belonging is incredibly important for survival. And so we have evolved over human history to like desperately need that sense of belonging for our survival. And so it's why we're drawn to people whose stories feel similar to our own, because we feel like, oh, if you've experienced it this way, then we're far more likely to be able to connect. And if we connect, then we can belong together. We can belong together. We can help each other stay alive, right? We don't think consciously in that way, but that's what's going on under the surface. And so, yeah, I think in an age where it's like, oh, I can get most things solved in a way practically based on my phone and speaking to Siri or to ChatGPT, there's going to be something deep within us that's hardwired for that belonging to other people, that we're going to like, okay, I have to find it. Even if I don't practically need you to solve a problem, I need you to like help me solve the belonging problem, which is a pretty important one.
Yeah, that's a huge one. In addition to finding these connections inside, say, the 10 by 9 space, or even the work you do one-on-one with people, how can we apply the experience to perhaps addressing some of the challenges that our communities and our society face with regard to polarization or difference or disconnect?
Storytelling, I think, shortens the distance between people, which means that just because you get close doesn't mean you use that closeness for good, right? It might help you like get close enough to get in stabbing range, you know? And people use stories to get people into proximity for really destructive means. And so I think it's important to pay attention to the power of story in this civil discourse and conversations. I think it's getting increasingly more difficult because we are getting in a place where we're not just disagreeing with the people that we disagree with, but we're assuming that they are a menace to society, right? That we're assuming that their motives are to destroy and that they are morally repugnant or evil. There's a book called Moving Beyond Sectarianism about Northern Ireland, but it has the scale of sectarian danger going from basically like we're different as the first one to you are demonic as the like 11th one and sort of the scale that we move down. And that some of those statements are really legit, like we're different or I'm right and you're wrong. Like there are some things where I do think I'm right and someone else is wrong. But then to move to like, because I'm right and you're wrong, you forfeit your ordinary rights. You're less valuable than I am. You are actually evil and you're actually demonic. Like, and we can get to that place. And I think there's like a sense to which, especially in the political sphere, we're much closer to the bottom than we are to the top. And so I think it's difficult for even stories to bring us up to that. And especially because there's somewhat of an inevitability I have found that trying to do story as like civil conversation, the people that show up are the people that already care about it anyway. So there's such a complicated problem to solve that I'm not sure, I haven't seen many people solve yet about how do we actually get the people in the room that are perpetuating these narratives. Because if you get people in a room to be like, let's tell each other stories, then they're there because they're at least somewhat curious about the other or because they like believe that this is a valuable thing. And so there's a degree that's like, yeah, this is helpful for them. But it's also like they're not necessarily the people that like need the transformation. And so, you know, I continue to feel stumped about like, how do we get those folks in a room?
You're listening to This Is Civity. I'm Gina Bellaria. We are talking with Michael McRae, experiential story coach and founder of Becoming Restoried. We're discussing the importance of reconciling yourself with your own story and truly hearing and engaging with the stories of others.
Like I think about in conflict resolution theory, there's something called the Penn diagram, which is this pyramid, and there's three different layers. So the bottom layer is the biggest, of course, in the middle, and then the top is the small part of the triangle. The top layer are positions, so that in conflict, when we argue, like most of the time we're arguing our positions. I believe this, I believe that, or this needs to happen, no, this needs to happen. Underneath the positions are interests, are things that we, goals that we have, interests that we have that are supporting our positions. And underneath the interests are needs. And the idea is that at the need, so PIN is position, interest, need, P-I-N, that what story allows us to do is to get to the level of the needs. And that's where we actually have the most possibility for common ground. I used to work for an organization called Narrative 4 that used story exchanges to build empathy. There was a story exchange that happened several years ago around gun violence. Paired up people across the kind of division of like gun reform. So one person was a guy named Todd. Another person was a woman named Carolyn. And they got to be partners. Carolyn had held her daughter in her arms as her daughter died from a mall shooting. And so she wanted basically all guns to disappear, more or less, amend the Constitution. Todd owns like 300 guns in his house, and his website orchestrated the sale of George Zimmerman's gun that killed Trayvon Martin. And so polar opposite positions, and they were story exchange partners. The way the story exchange works is I have to tell you a story from my life, you tell me one from yours, and then I have to retell your story in first person pronouns as if your story happened to me. And so what was amazing was that as we listened to the story, one of the things that we heard was that that for Todd, he began to believe in guns because he grew up in a deeply abusive household, a father that was abusive. And when he was a teenager, he grabbed a gun and pointed it at his dad and said, enough is enough, and the abuse stopped. So what fires together wires together. And so for Todd, guns keep him safe, right? For Carolyn, guns killed her daughter. So not having guns is what keeps people safe. So the need is actually the same, right? To feel safe in this world, but it's manifesting in polar opposite positions. But if you can get into the story, you are able to see, oh, we're trying to accomplish the same thing in a way. Our positions are very irreconcilable in one way, but we both want the same thing. And maybe it will change the way that I talk to you if I can understand that you're wanting the same thing I am. And can we find a collaborative way to go about it? Doesn't always mean that we agree. In fact, rarely it means that we agree. Doesn't even always mean that we can have a great conversation. But it helps me be like, oh, you're not just some like evil, crazy person that like wants to take away my freedom or wants everyone to have, you know, 300 guns. It's like, oh, yeah, you you're trying to be safe and secure in this world. Yeah, me too.
Yeah, exactly. You're not evil. You're just a human. And yeah, and I love finding those moments of, oh, we want the same thing and we see it in a different way. You do this work with individuals on sharing their personal story, and yet you wrote a book about polarization. I am not your enemy. You wrote a book about us seeing each other's humanity, which can seemingly on the surface seem like a big shift, but it's very, I mean, I think you and I both know it's very related. But I would love to talk a little bit about what prompted you to write this book. Why did you decide to sit down and write this and put this out in the world?
Multiple threads, as always. I mean, I'd done the conflict resolution masters, so I've lived in Belfast. And I developed, I think, an interest in international conflict and peace building because I grew up going to Israel and Palestine. I mentioned my granddad was an archaeologist. My dad spent a year in Jerusalem as a kid. My first international trip when I was 11 was to Jerusalem. I've been 14 times now to Israel and Palestine. And so I grew up going to a place that I fell in love with and learned about the nature of the injustice and the violence that was happening there. And then wanted to like be part in some way of trying to bring healing or peace, justice, reconciliation, whatever it might be. And so I was oriented to international work in that way. I also just love travel. I love being in different places. So then when I did the conflict resolution masters, just thought like, yeah, like I really want to work in resolving these conflicts. Again, it's also tying to my personal story of the conflict within myself and experiencing violence from other people and wanting to deal with that. The book actually came about because there was a Fulbright fellowship with National Geographic and digital storytelling. And I was like, okay, I need this immediately. So I applied for it. And what I proposed was to basically spend 3 months in South Africa, 3 months in Northern Ireland, and 3 months in Israel, Palestine, gathering stories of people living life in divided societies. And how are they able to do this without trying to kill each other? Because at the time, the Ferguson uprising was happening. Israel was bombing Gaza. Not much has changed. ISIS was beheading people in the news. And I was very aware that the stories that we tell ourselves, the stories that we pay attention to, directly affect the breadth of our imagination. And so if I'm only paying attention to stories that are about violent beginnings, violent middles, and violent ends, that's what I'm going to imagine is possible in the world. And so I was like, we actually have to be pretty intentional in going and finding stories of people who have lived in this violence, but are able to get to a place of saying, you don't have to be my enemy. There's actually another thing that we can do here. So I was like, I want to go find those stories. Now, I didn't get the Fulbright Fellowship, but there was a university in Texas that I would once work with, TCU, and they said, hey, we'd actually love to fund a shorter version of this. And I was like, fantastic. So they gave me some money, and I spent 3 months traveling in those areas doing a more condensed version. It came from a sense of we can't be lackadaisical about the stories. Like we're always consuming stories and we can't be asleep at the wheel. Like Howard Zinn, the late historian, says that all storytelling is selective, right? We can't hear and tell every story. It's not possible. So it's always selective. So the stories that we do tell, the stories that we do listen to, reveal our biases and our prejudices and our leanings. So if the stories that I'm consuming and telling are going to inform the way that I think about the world and what's possible, then I have a responsibility to do that well and intentionally. And I also just knew like, oh yeah, one of my gifts is being able to tell stories, to gather stories, to have conversation. So let me travel the world and find these. And the whole book is oriented to, let's look at places where we all acknowledge there was conflict and to see what do these stories have to say about the place that we live in? Because we seem to not want to acknowledge that we live in a conflict zone, but we very much do. And so like, what do these stories have to say about this place? Because to me, there's not much good in me traveling internationally. Just be like, let me just tell you about Northern Ireland and South Africa. It's like, most of us will never go there. It's like, what does that, what we've learned there, have to say about the city that you're in, the town that you're in, the people that live next door? Like, always got to bring it back home.
I totally agree. Yeah, no, I think that's one of our big challenges here in the U.S. is really facing that knowledge, that reality. And, you know, there's a quote, and I'm going to be perfectly frank. I got that someone actually was lovely enough to put this quote on Goodreads. So I found this book quote that's so civity that I wanted to read it, that you wrote, we cannot be interested only in forgiveness, kindness, empathy, and compassion. We must also consider things like power, generational trauma, redistribution of resources, reparations for harm, economic empowerment, and what to do with 400 years of grieving. Advocates of reconciliation and advocates of justice must work together as colleagues, or we may quite ironically fight one another like enemies. And there's so much in there that just dovetails with what Civity believes is the idea of empathy, compassion, kindness, but power and all of those other aspects inform our relationships and how we are with each other, and how story can cut through some of that.
Appreciate you reading that. I mean, part of where that came from for me was thinking about a theme that emerged in the book, was that people that are in power in these conflict areas are far more interested in talking about reconciliation and far less interested in talking about justice. And the people that are on the underside of power have the opposite reaction. And so it made me think a lot about, like, what are we putting into this concept of reconciliation that feels so safe to the people in power and so threatening to the people that aren't in power? And to say that, like, often when we're doing story work, when we're doing reconciliation work, especially if you think about race in the United States, we're rarely sufficiently taking into consideration the power dynamics in the room. We're not on equal playing fields, right? This isn't just a sense of like, oh, if we could just get white folks and black folks in a room to tell stories, like we'll see each other with humanity. It's like, great. And also, what are they going to do about the fact that there's still this massive income disparity, right? Or that there's things built into the laws, into the systems that disproportionately affect the folks of color and the white folks. It's just like, it's not equal. There can get to a point where those programs make the thing worse, because it's creating a false narrative in our minds that, like, oh, like we're buddy-buddy now. Everything is fine. I've seen the humanity. We're all good. And it's like, yeah, but justice has got to be part of this, right? It's like these things have to work together. Because like in Israel-Palestine, you can bring Israelis and Palestinians together and like have beautiful conversations of like feeling like they've seen each other's stories. They're becoming friends. But then they have to go back on opposite sides of a wall, like a 25-foot wall. And then they can't access each other. Palestinians are still living under military control with relatively little freedom. And so it's like, great. Yeah. So you can have these like reconciling conversations, but without justice, where are they going to go? Right. But you can also pursue justice, take down the wall in the occupation. And if no one is tending to the stories that we're telling each other about each other, the fierce narrative will remain and we'll find new ways to create division between us, right? Just like in Northern Ireland, you know, that they had the peace accords that were signed in 1998. And since then, over 100 peace walls have been built between Catholics and Protestants because the narrative didn't change. And so it's like, okay, yes, we're at peace, but I'm still afraid of this other person. So I need to feel safe. Build me a wall. Now that the fact that the wall exists means that I should be afraid of what's on the other side. And it just keeps, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so I think for story work to be done well, it has to focus, yes, on like shortening the distance, helping us see the humanity, but also being like, oh, now that we're talking, I'm hearing your story, I realize how unfair and like unjust your life is compared to mine. Maybe if I'm actually interested in reconciling a relationship, I should do something about it. And so I think we always have to be aware of that, especially in the context of things like race or injustice, we are asking more of the people on the underside of power in the room. You know, we're asking more of the black folks in the room to be able to sit with patience to listen to white people talk about their stories than we are asking of the white people to listen to the folks of color. It takes more emotional labor. And so how are we tending to that reality?
You brought up empathy earlier, and you also discussed curiosity as an important aspect of this work. And I actually wrote a book for journalism students on how to cultivate curiosity, empathy, tenacity, because I think kids, you know, technology and other realities of young people's lives mean they haven't cultivated curiosity the way I might have when I was younger. I think what you just described was why curiosity is important, why you think curiosity is important to name, or even how you might approach teaching people to cultivate curiosity.
A keynote that I do called How to Dismantle an Enemy. And the idea is that like if we want to break down the notion of an enemy, we have to at least have three things. The first is proximity. We actually have to get closer to the thing that we're judging or afraid of. The second is we have to have humility, meaning, like I think about a friend of mine talks about Snoopy theology, and he was referring to this Snoopy comic strip where Charlie Brown approaches Snoopy, who's on his doghouse, and he says, I hear you're writing a book of theology. And he says to Snoopy, I hope you have a good title. And Snoopy says, I have the best title. And the title was, Has It Ever Occurred to You That You Might Be Wrong? Right? Which is fantastic. And I'm like, what a great title for a book on like dialogue and reconciliation. Has it ever occurred to you that you might be wrong? And so we have to have the humility to say, okay, yes, I've got things I believe about you, but I also have to be open to the fact that I might have heard a false story or that I might have created something that isn't true. And that maybe you have something to teach me about you that I don't already know. And maybe even you have something to teach me about myself that I can't see. And so then from that, there has to be curiosity. I have to be aware that I might not know everything. And then to extend myself in curiosity to say, so what do I need to know in order to truly understand you? Because that's what I would want people to do for me, right? That's like, it's it's the golden rule. Treat people the way you want them to treat you. And to be like, yeah, I would really love if someone has an issue with me, that they approach me with curiosity to say, help me understand why you're doing what you're doing. My friend Padraig O Tuama has a beautiful book called In the Shelter. And he has a line in there that says, most people do what seems reasonable to them at the time, most of the time. Most people do what seems reasonable to them at the time, most of the time, which leaves a little room for people to be unreasonable for the sake of being unreasonable. But it is to say, like, most people's behavior seems makes sense to them. And so it's like, what kind of story would I have to tell about myself and the world and the other for that to be a reasonable position to take, for that to be a reasonable way to engage? And I don't know how to do that without getting curious about it. It's working with people on, like, how do we ask the right questions? And the right questions are typically pretty open-ended ones. Like, I'm fairly uninterested in questions that end with yes or no answers. You know, to the lots of kind of why and how questions. A good question often gets a good response. And so, yeah, I think just orienting to the fact that, like, in order for me to feel like I'm really being understood, I really want someone to be curious about my lived experience. And why on earth should I expect that from someone else if I'm not willing to do it for them?
For people who don't think they have a story to tell, what do you say to people who might be reluctant to sort of step into a conversation about difference or share a vulnerability? How do you help people sort of find their stories or excavate their stories or feel okay or even confident that they do have a story?
I talk about the three G's as like pitfalls in storytelling, that we think our stories have to be grand, game changers, or gold mines. And that, like, that we had this expectation that, oh, my story's not, even kind of, you know, you didn't necessarily say this, but even what you hinted at the beginning, to be like, well, my story's not quite as dramatic as yours, right? And we put this pressure on ourselves to be like, well, because I wasn't assaulted or bullied, my story's not that interesting. It's like, no, that was just mine. Yours is your own. Like, it doesn't need to be like grand and epic and dramatic. It also doesn't have to be full of like, of all these little gold mines of wisdom, to be like, well, I don't know how to tell a story that's just like full of lessons. It's like, it doesn't need to be. In fact, sometimes the most effective stories are not ones that are trying to teach people something. Just tell me what happened. At 10 by 9, we actually tell people you cannot give a moral to your story. Just tell us what happened and let us decide what we're going to take from it. Because as soon as I give a moral to the story, I potentially even alienate the audience, because they might have been listening thinking, oh, I took something very different from that. And now I actually kind of feel like you're stepping over onto my side and telling me what to do with it. And there's a theologian, I always forget his name, who says the storyteller cannot control the power of the story to reveal. I don't have a monopoly on what my story means. And so, like, you get to do something with it. And neither do our stories have to be game changers. It's like, okay, well, if I'm going to tell a story, it needs to like shift something. It's like, that's way too much pressure. So I just often encourage people, it's just like, I'm just interested to know what your experience was. And the way I define a story is how we talk about our experience of what's happened to us. It's as simple as that. It's how we talk about our experience of what's happened to us. So a lot of times I think people feel like they don't have stories because they have false expectations around comparison. Because maybe the only time they've encountered what we call storytelling is like professional things like The Moth or, you know, or like watching Netflix or whatever. And just like, oh, I'm not that storyteller. It's like, you tell stories all the time. You go out to a drink with a friend. You're like, oh my gosh, like my ex just texted me. You won't believe what they said, right? Like, you're telling a story, right? It's just like, or like, oh my goodness, like my boss came into my office the other day and like I felt like freaked out because I didn't know it was. It's like, we're telling a story. Story's just about how we our experience of our life. Most of the time people feel like they don't have stories because they haven't been asked the right questions. And so I love to find prompts that help people that like are specific but general enough that anyone can have a story. Like a few that I really love, like, tell me a story of a time when you knew your life wouldn't be the same. Everyone's got one, right? And it could be a really positive change or a really difficult change. Tell a story of a time when you had to make a decision that's still affecting you today. Could have been like the day that I decided to get married, or the day I decided to get divorced, or the day I took that job, or the day I decided to quit. Could have been the day I decided to have my kid, or the day that I had to decide to take my father off of the ventilator at the hospital, right? It's like everyone's got something. Tell a story of a time when you were surprised by someone that you thought you knew, or tell a story of a time when you were very aware of feeling different from the people around you. We get good stories if we ask good story questions. And so I think most people just haven't been asked a good story question. As soon as they're asked the right question, they realize that they've got lots of things to talk about.
I love that. You're right. Those in particular, I was like, oh yeah, that's very good. So is there anything I haven't asked you that you want to say that you feel it's important for people to know?
For a long time, my work was focused on thinking about social conflict. How do we use stories to shorten distance between people and resolve conflict? And right now, through my coaching program, Becoming Restoried, I'm interested in like, what does that look like inside of the parts and pieces of ourselves, right? There are people and parts out in the world in social conflict, but we have social conflict within us because we are not one thing. We have all these different parts that are in relationship to each other. So how do I take the same principles of conflict resolution, reconciliation, storytelling, and apply them to the stories that I tell myself about myself? How do I reconcile these pieces that are in tension within me? So that I can try to live with more curiosity, compassion for myself, and purpose. That's what I'm really excited about now is doing that through experiential story work and helping people restory their lives. But there's a story you tell yourself about yourself, and it's probably not very generous or compassionate. How can we change the story so that you can live the life you really want to live? Yeah, I really love it.
Thank you to my guest, Michael McRae, experiential story coach and founder of Becoming Restoried. Find out more at becomingrestoried.com. Civity is a culture of deliberately engaging in relationships of respect and empathy with others who are different, moving people from us versus them to we all belong. To learn more, go to civity.org. Left, right, black, or